Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Daniel Smith. I'm here for a brief time just to introduce Simone Collins. For those of you who are wanting to see Charlie, apparently he's had to duck off to do some work. So I think from our perspective, we're actually better off with Simone here. I'm sure she'll do a sterling job. Simone's worked for UWI for almost 5 years and managed the home insurance actuarial team there. The role covers pricing, reserving, reinsurance and product design. And prior to this, she was at APRA. So please welcome Simone.
Thanks, everyone. Yes, unfortunately, Charlie did have to duck back to the office this morning, so I got a text message at about 8 o'clock asking if I could take his place and do this presentation instead. So, yes, we'll see how we go. So today I'm going to be talking to you about catastrophe model assumptions, uncertainty and reinsurance structure response. So even if you don't personally work in the reinsurance space or the catastrophe modelling space, it is still important from an actuarial perspective to understand some of the uncertainties and assumptions that go into the catastrophe modelling, because in the FCR and the ICAP commentary that's required by APRA, you need to be able to make commentary on whether an insurance or reinsurance structure is appropriate, an assessment of the adequacy of the ICRC. All of these sorts of things are in the more traditional actuarial space. So I'm going to go through today some aspects of this that should help to at least get you thinking about some of the uncertainty aspects that could come through with this commentary. So we'll be looking at models, and in particular some of the assumptions and the parameters that go into these catastrophe models, the uncertainty that then comes along with these catastrophe models, how this plays out in reinsurance wording, so in the reinsurance contract designs, and then also how you can design a reinsurance structure to try to compensate or to alleviate some of this uncertainty that's inherent within this catastrophe modelling space. So first of all, we'll start by looking at the assumptions and parameters that go into the catastrophe modelling. So you've got your model inputs and your mapping. So, you know, it'll put into the models where your risks are located, the houses, the cars, not really prepared. Yes, so you'll need to map things like, is it a brick house? Is it a timber house? Is it a corporate portfolio where you might have individual large structures that need to go into these catastrophe models? Some of these might have missing values, so you might not know what is this structure made out of. You might not know where is this structure exactly located. And a lot of these catastrophe models do rely on having a location. So it might be that you want to put in an exact lat long coordinates for the address, but you might not have anything beyond a postcode level, which can affect the results of these catastrophe models and what actually comes out of them. So how do you deal with these missing values when you're running them through the catastrophe models? As well as that, there's the underlying exposure projection. So if you have a fast-growing portfolio or a portfolio that is growing in particular regions at a faster pace than the rest of the portfolio, you need to be able to make some sort of projection of how that exposure will look over the coming 12 months, because for example, if you're running your catastrophe models to be able to do your reinsurance purchasing as of 1 July 2016, you need to purchase that for a whole 12 months. So what will your portfolio look like as of 1 July 2017, and how uncertain is that, and how much will that affect the top layer of your reinsurance or the reinsurance limit that you need to buy to? So that's another uncertainty that can come along with this model projections. Underinsurance is another one that's quite often spoken about within the catastrophe modelling. So if you, for example, have a home insurance portfolio, a lot of these catastrophe models will give a percentage of sum insured loss. So if your sums insured are lower than what they would otherwise need to be, this assumption can create a lot of model miss. It can create a lot of uncertainty as to how those losses would actually play out in practice. Because if you're saying this is a 50% of sum insured loss and your sum insured should be $500,000, not $250,000, then that's going to be a big underestimation of the amount of losses that you could have. The additional loss costs. So a lot of reinsurance contracts have built into them additional benefits for the consumers, so things like a removal of debris benefit, temporary accommodation, so if a customer isn't able to live in their house for a period of time after an event, they'll need to have some temporary accommodation costs paid for. In the event of, say, a hailstorm where their car is a write-off, they might need a hire car in the meantime, or even if the car's being repaired, they'll need to cover that additional cost there. So how do you actually build these additional costs into your catastrophe modelling? If, for example, you're looking at a removal of debris benefit, it might be that this benefit only comes into effect when there's a total loss on the house, because if it's not a total loss, then you don't really have much debris to remove. I mean, there might be a little bit, but how do you model that aspect of, is this particular address a total loss or not? And the additional one there is demand surge. So again, this is another one that's pretty widely spoken about within catastrophe modelling, but how does this actually come out in practice? You have a range of different events with a range of different sizes. If an event hits, say, Cairns, where it's a much more isolated area in terms of getting suppliers and in terms of getting builders and the like up there, as opposed to a similar size event, say, hitting Sydney, when there's a lot more resources available to be able to help out and, you know, to be able to get the builders in and the like. So how do you actually model that aspect of where the event hits and also what size it is? Because as the events get bigger in size, the resources constraints become bigger as well. So you need to be able to factor in the size and the location of the events in these catastrophe models to be able to get an understanding of how the demand surge aspect will look. So there's some of the uncertainties that goes into the inputs of the models. There's also uncertainty within the models themselves. So this, if you've ever heard the vendors or the brokers, catastrophe modellers speaking, they'll tell you that there's a lot of stuff that actually isn't covered in these models. So, for example, if you're looking at cyclone, the flood following cyclone just completely is not modelled at all. And this can be quite a big loss cost, as most of you probably be aware. There's also the random error in terms of each of these models picks a certain simulation of event sets, but the particular event that happens might not have been modelled within that event set. So there's the randomness of the event that does actually end up occurring is always going to be different to what the model says in terms of location, in terms of size. So there's that random uncertainty that comes along with that aspect of it as well. And then there's a completely unmodeled error. So there's perils that aren't included in these models. So, for example, most of the vendor models don't include severe convective storms or East Coast lows. There's also things that we haven't even experienced in terms of catastrophe modelling at all, so like solar flares and all of these sorts of completely out there, unmodelled losses that can occur. So just wanted to give a bit of background there. So this is just to give you an idea of what a traditional occurrence exceedance probability curve looks like. So you'll have your return period along the axis here, and then the amount of losses, say in billions of dollars here. So you might look at this and say, okay, a 1 in 200 year event, that will cost us around $1.5 billion. But this is coming out just straight from these catastrophe models and usually isn't accounting for all of these additional uncertainties in terms of the parameters, in terms of the assumptions that goes into that. And so usually adjustments are made to this curve to try to compensate for some of those things and to try to account for some of these additional losses that can occur. So in terms of the unmodelled aspects, we've all seen the example of Christchurch earthquake. That was absolutely not modelled in any of the catastrophe models that came out. They all focused on Wellington as being the place where these big earthquakes were going to be happening. A lot of the liquefaction aspects weren't accounted for. And so we've seen this massive loss that was just completely not accounted for in any of these catastrophe models. And there's examples like that from all over the world where these perils come along that even though, you know, we do model earthquakes, we don't model that particular type of earthquake. So what could that look like for cyclones? One of the things that we have been speaking about is potential for losses from asbestos contamination. So if you think, for example, a cyclone coming through an area that hasn't been hit for a long time by a cyclone, say the area north of Brisbane, where you've got a lot of these old fibro asbestos type of houses, when a cyclone comes along and whips up and breaks down these houses, you might have some that are completely unaffected or only slightly affected by the cyclone itself. But then you've got this asbestos blowing into their house, and that can make the house completely unlivable. It can mean that you're total lossing houses that the models say actually should withstand the cyclone pretty well, and actually they might withstand the cyclone pretty well, but the customers aren't able to live in the house, and then that might have then the whole cost of demolishing the house, of rebuilding the house, of scraping the land to get rid of any asbestos contamination. And if you think, you know, a whole sort of suburb or a whole city of all of these affected houses, that can get very expensive very quickly. I mentioned before as well the coincident flooding, so again, not included in any of the models, but is a big factor in terms of the losses that these cyclones can generate. If we look at hail losses, so for example, if you have a horrendously big hailstorm and there's 500,000 hail damaged cars, what's that going to do to the secondhand car market? So you might have a car that the original value, insured value on that car is say $25,000. But because there's so many damaged cars, you cannot find that car for $25,000 anymore. You'll have to go out to the market, pay maybe $35,000. You might have to pay costs to get it shipped in from another state. And then if it was large enough, it might even have effects on the whole of your motor portfolio, because now there's such a high demand for secondhand cars that any accident that you have to write off one of these cars means that you'll end up paying a higher market value for the car after one of these large hailstorms comes through. Another one that is quite pertinent for these catastrophe models is the additional loss adjustment expenses. So if you think about a large catastrophe coming through and what that means for the operations of an insurance company. So you'll need to hire extra claim staff, you'll need to have somewhere to have these claim staff seated, you'll need to have the assessors who will be able to go out there, you'll need to have the staff equipment, so computers and the like, maybe advertising costs to tell customers how to lodge their claim, where to go. You might have assessment setters set up which can be, for example, for a large hailstorm, a drive-in assessment centre where customers can take their cars and get them assessed quite quickly. You might have legal costs where you potentially have disputes with customers and then these go through the court system and the like. And these costs, they're not insignificant. So if, you know, your claims area is at, you know, needing to double or triple in size, think about all of the staff and the costs that come along with that. We've heard reports from Christchurch that these expenses were in excess of 10% of the claims costs. So if you think about that on, you know, a billions of dollars event, 10% of those claims costs being in terms of these additional staff and additional loss adjustment expenses. But do the catastrophe models actually include these expenses? So we actually went out there and asked a few vendors whether they saw that these expenses were included in the models. In the Australian models, the answer was not explicitly. So there might be some built into the reporting of losses that then feed into the models themselves. But generally, no. The loss adjustment expenses... The LAE has been removed from the claims and the model has been calibrated excluding those losses. So in Australia, at least, they're completely taken out. New Zealand is a different story. They are implicitly included in there, but not in the Australian models. So if you're thinking about a 1 in 200 year event, what sort of cost does that add on to the top of those events that need to be included within your APRA-regulated 1 in 200 year loss? So these expenses really don't start to bite until it does get to be quite a big loss. And I think we're relatively lucky in the Australian market that we haven't really seen something of this magnitude which can really push those assumptions to see where they can go. But if you're looking at, you know, return periods of 1 in 200, 1 in 300, it does start to become quite a significant portion of the loss, these additional loss adjustment expenses. So in terms of the reinsurance wording, these loss adjustment expenses are generally included in the ultimate net loss of the reinsurance treaty, which is good because it means that you can recover these costs from the reinsurance and then they don't have to be included within the capital calculations. The reinsurers also allow for this in their pricing because they know that they'll be paying some of these claims. But the reinsurance wordings themselves can be tricky in that they might exclude some things which actually you'd think should be included in these loss adjustment expense costs. So, for example, this is an example of one contract wording. The ultimate net loss, and this is a really long definition, I apologise, but the ultimate net loss includes adjustment expenses, litigation, all other expenses, other than the salaries of employees and office expenses of the reinsured. Now, the intention of this from a reinsurer's perspective is to get rid of any sort of business as usual operational costs from the reinsured that they don't want to have to pay. But the salaries of employees become a vital part and become a much more expensive part when you do have these large events to that you need to pay for. And does this then leave open for contradiction that, say, you're hiring temporary staff rather than employing staff? Are the temporary staff costs covered, but the additional staff that you have to put on aren't covered and the like? So there can just be a few nuances in terms of the reinsurance wordings that really can affect how much these costs are or aren't covered. So we can adjust this wording, for example, to actually include anything over and above the business as usual type expenses or something along those lines, so that you do actually have these costs covered by the reinsurer, because the intention of the reinsurance is to cover expenses that would otherwise have not been incurred if not for the catastrophe event happening. So for some of those things that might not be included in the reinsurance contract, really the total retained loss, which goes into the ICRC calculation, would need to include those loss adjustment expenses that can't be recovered from the reinsurance. So at the moment it might be assumed that you can recover all of these costs, but care needs to be taken in reading the reinsurance contract wording and get a real understanding of what is and isn't included within there so that you know what this unrecovered portion of the additional loss adjustment expenses would be to then add that to the ICRC calculation, because it could mean that the at the top limit of cover isn't sufficient at a 1 in 200 level to cover the loss plus these additional expenses. All right, So that's the assumptions and the reinsurance wordings. So I'm going to talk quickly about a reinsurance structure that can help to offset some of this uncertainty and get some thought in that space. So at the moment, a traditional reinsurance structure is pretty much dictated by the APRA requirements. So you buy a 1 in 200 level of cover with a reinstatement, and then you might have a few extra layers down the bottom to cover the H3 and H4 requirements. You might have a margin on top of the 1 in 200 year event for your model miss or your out-the-top risk. The question is, how many reinstatements do you have at various levels? And that's really where the structuring decisions come in. So you might have some drop-downs, aggregates and the like to protect that underneath cover there, the sort of down the bottom multiple perils risks. But the only way at the moment that the top risk is being protected is by buying an additional margin above the 1 in 200 year. It's called sleep easy cover in the market there. But really the question is, how much extra cover is enough there? So you're buying to a 1 in 250 year event, a 1 in 300 year event. And what's your level of comfort that your cover will cover you up to sort of a 1 in 300 year event? And how much does that extra cover cost? If you're looking at reinsurance, minimum rates online for those top level covers, it's not particularly cost efficient sometimes to buy that extra $250 million worth of cover up the top. But then what's the trade-off within the company? What's the risk appetite for out the top risk versus the cost that you're willing to pay to protect it? So this is just a structuring example that you might have sort of different layers of the traditional structure might cover you up to sort of 1 in 200, or if you've got the additional loss adjustment expenses, maybe not quite 1 in 200. And, for example, a total cover of this $3.175 billion in various prepaid reinstatement structures. So the questions there, would the limit be enough, as I've already touched on? You can't access the reinstatement if the limits run out. So if you do have an event that goes out the top of your cover, that second reinstatement's not going to be able to cover you there. That's only for an absolute second event. So it's not to reinstate the cover for that first event that's going out the top. And also, if you do have something that goes through quite a substantial amount of your reinsurance, you would need to buy backup cover, which can be quite expensive because you're backing up for a chance of another event, which sort of is that lower type of event there. So this is an alternative for a reinsurance structure that addresses this model miss, and that is a more cost-effective potential way to buy the reinsurance cover. So the traditional layer here, you've got your 1 in 200 plus a reinstatement plus these lower level reinstatements. If we take all of this second, third, fourth level covers and just put them on top of this tower here, you basically just have one large uber tower of cover called a cascading tower. So the total capacity is the same here, so we're not adding any additional capacity. But what we're doing is saying that for a single loss, you're able to recover the actual total capacity of that reinsurance. It's not limited to a 1 in 200 year loss plus a reinstatement. So if there was an event that went over and above this 1 in 200 year level, you could cover it right up to sort of two times plus some, the 1 in 200 year level. So it's essentially a giant aggregate cover in separated up into layers potentially. It doesn't necessarily need to be separated up into layers, but that's more to appeal to reinsurers' capacity and reinsurers' liking for whether they, you know, want to have cover down low or up the top, or to try and get the price optimization there. So this is just a comparative example with the layering. I might just go to the next. Oh, okay. So we've got the return period here. So you can see that the return period of the cascading limit is much, much higher than the traditional 1 in 200 year reinstatements. We're talking probably out to 1 in 1,000 type year return periods in some cases. So this is the comparative chart here. You've got your traditional limit, 1 in 200 year, the cascading limit way above that. So it might just be easier if I give you an example of how these losses would actually look in the layers. And I'm a visual person, so I might just try and use this one here. So the cascading versus the traditional recoveries in terms of multiple losses. So the cascading tower here on the left, you'll still have a retention each and every time. That doesn't change. So for this example, we've used a $75 million retention for your reinsurance layer. The first loss here goes into the tower, and it's exactly the same recovery as what you'd get with the traditional reinstatement type of structure. So you've got $125 million recovery from your first layer and then $120 million from your second layer. In the cascading example, if we then have a second loss, the idea is that you've basically used this proportion of cover-up for your first loss, and you just start recovering from further up in the tower, or if you think of it, sort of the blocks of cover have been taken out and the whole thing cascades down, and you can still chew through the recoveries from there. So the next one, you've got another, sorry, my eyesight's not good, $80 million recovery from this second layer here, and then it goes up into the third and fourth layer. Whereas in the traditional one, you're using up now the reinstatements of your cover that you hadn't used before. So you've got another $125 million from your first layer, which is the reinstatement of that first layer, then $200 million and then $200 million from the third layer there as well. So you can see that the operation is slightly different in terms of where the recoveries come from, because there's no reinstatements on the cascading tower. It's all just one single shot of cover up to that 2 times 1 in 200 plus some limit there. So there's multiple benefits for this. So backup cover is another one. If you need to buy backup cover for your traditional reinsurance, you're buying backup at the bottom of the tower or the bottom of the cover, so that as soon as you have another loss, it goes into that first $75 million or whatever it is that your retention is, which can become quite expensive. But for a cascading tower, you're buying your backup cover at the top of the tower. So if you do have a loss that goes up into some of your tower, you're then backing up right at the top, which has such a small probability of entry and exit that it would be much cheaper to buy the cover there than it would be to buy the cover on the traditional basis. For example, if we look at a single $2 billion event, which is over and above the traditional 1 in 200 year layer limit, for the traditional one, you have a $475 million retained loss, because you have the $75 million retained loss at the bottom plus the additional $400 million at the top as the cover blows out up the top. Whereas this cascading cover, because it's one Uber tower of cover, you actually can recover the whole cost there. So you've got your only $75 million, so the actual reinsurance retention retained there. In addition to that, if we go back to this one here, if you're looking at sideways risk, the cascading cover deals with that quite nicely as well, because you can have as many smaller events here that chew through $1.9 billion worth of cover, whereas for the traditional cover, you only are limited to the amount of reinstatements that you purchase at the bottom of your tower. So it's that protection that goes upwards and the protection that goes sideways that's really beneficial from this type of cover. So in terms of pricing this type of cover, you would expect it to be a bit more expensive than your traditional buy, but maybe not as expensive as you might expect it to be. And there's a few reasons for that. As I said before, people or companies are buying the sleep easy type cover, so that level of cover above the 1 in 200 year limit at the moment. So they're already paying more for their reinsurance than they otherwise would be. So you've got to take that cost and deduct it from this comparative difference when you're looking at this cascading type structure. And as well as that, the minimum rates online, or the rates that the reinsurers charge, will get much, much smaller in these top layers, because the probability of entry of one of these top layers is above 1 in 200. And the probability of exit, as I said, is probably about 1 in 1,000. So if you can get the reinsurers to offer suitable minimum rates online for those top level covers, then the price comparison actually becomes not so large. So it's really a trade-off between a company's risk appetite in terms of the model miss factors, and in terms of, you know, all of this uncertainty that goes into the modelling itself, and how much they're willing to pay to mitigate those costs. So in summary, the only thing that's certain about cat modelling is that there are many sources of uncertainty and we're never going to get it right. And the best... Well, what we see is the best way to address this is to actually structure the reinsurance to be able to adequately deal with this uncertainty that comes along in the catastrophe modelling space, because some of it is quite significant. And again, the reinsurance wordings also create uncertainty. So really, there's a need to seek that contract certainty and to really understand what it is that is covered, and more importantly, what it is that isn't covered in terms of the expenses and costs that can come out of these claims that you will ultimately be relying on your reinsurers to pay. In the event of a big event, you don't want to be having to have this arm wrestle with your reinsurers. You want to be able to do what's right for your customers, what's in the best interest of your company, and to not have to go and seek permission or seek clarity from the reinsurers before you make these business decisions. So it's good to have that clarity up front, so that there's not, you know, in the time when a big event does happen, there's not this arm wrestling that goes on. Sleep easy structure. I mean, how easy are you really sleeping with a 1 in 250 versus a 1 in 200 year level buy? If you are sleeping much easier at night, maybe you should have another think about that. And that cascading structure, just how well it can actually box out that out the top risk that does come along with the uncertainty that I've shown you here today. So that's the costings, already touched on that. And yes, so again, coming back to the FCR commentary and how all of this reflects in the assessment of the adequacy of the reinsurance structures and the reinsurance purchases. Thank you.
Thanks, Simone. We do have about 7 minutes for questions. If anyone's got any questions, there's the mic in the middle there. Please come up and name, rank, serial number and ask away. Don't be shy. Well, while you're thinking of a question, Simone, I'm not a reinsurance expert in any means, so please, if my question's naive, just tell me. Is the cascading structure effectively just a cat stop-loss cover?
No, because you do still need to have an event. So it'll have an each and every event retention of $75 million. It's not like an aggregate of all claims. So it's, yeah, slightly different. It's more aligned with the traditional reinsurance structure, just that it does have an aggregate per event type of structure. Is that...
Right, but and so the event's got to be above an amount, but you then wouldn't have your retention for each subsequent event.
No, it is an each and every event retention. So each and every event you have a retention of $75 million. Over and above that is where the differences start to come through.
Right, okay. I might have to re-look at those diagrams.
Yeah, okay, maybe Jim. I'll just... Here we go. Yes, yeah, so for each of these events that come through, there is still the $75 million retention. I'm not sure if it's easier to show it as being recovery from up the tower, or if you show the tower sort of dropping down here, but you have that $75 million for the second event as well, but then you start recovering just from this point in the tower. So you've already sort of chewed up that area, and then the next recovery is from the place where the previous recovery stopped.
So it's effectively which reinsurers pay, which is different.
Yes, and as I said, you don't even necessarily need to have it in layers. It could just be one uber big tower, which would be a potential way to structure it. But the reason we've broken it into layers here is A, for demonstration, and B, like I said, for price optimization, because you might get some reinsurers who are more able to adequately price at the top or down the bottom of this type of structure.
Yeah, good summary, Simone, of the sources of, also the sources of the model miss, or the costs that don't fall out of the model runs. There's another one I'm kind of concerned about at the moment that I thought I'd just throw in there, and that is you mentioned the post-event demand surge, and we've actually recently been seeing some really high levels of claims inflation in the property classes, and in the last year, potentially of the order of 30% inflation in claims costs. And that's not necessarily inflation that's been built into some insured, and perhaps nor necessarily should it be, because it might be just focused around the repair cost rather than the cost of a new home. And so that's perhaps another reason why the models may be missing some of the costs at the moment, because those building repair costs, it's in effect a pre-event surge in costs that needs to be factored in as well. And again, another benefit you'd get from your cascading approach.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
We still do have some time for questions, if anyone, or comments, quite welcome to. You can get out of your seat, Will, too. You've got legs.
Hi, Simon. I'm just curiosity in how the reinsurance market react, your experience of placing this program in the market.
Yes, so we did explore this quite extensively with the reinsurance market. Some took a little while to get their heads around what we were actually trying to do here. Some were quite supportive and really understood the incentives and understood the structure. In the end, for us, it came down to a question of cost and what cost we were willing to pay to mitigate some of these risks. So for us, it's an ongoing dialogue. But the appetite is definitely there to be able to write these covers, because I think in the reinsurance market at the moment, the reinsurers are sort of maybe waking up to the fact that they need to be able to be flexible and to be able to support customers, to be able to retain the business. Because this sort of structure as well opens up the collateralized markets, because there's none of that question of reinstatement costs or, you know, how to structure reinstatements into the reinsurance there. So that as well can bring price tension in there. So, yeah, in summary, we have explored this. We would be able to place it at a cost, but the maybe underlying reason for bringing it here today is if more people want to explore this, then maybe the cost will come down as well. So,
you got 5 seconds to make it to the mic, Will.
I feel like I'm at a wedding or something. When you were talking earlier about the asbestos. Now, that's something that George Walker, my former colleague, used to go on about Townsville. He said the whole town is open to that. Let's say you've got two insurers, though, in town. Like, say, Suncorp are insuring one side of the road and Huey's insuring the other. And let's say your building gets destroyed, you know, and the asbestos goes into the Suncorp building and makes that building written off. Who pays for that building written off, the second one? Is that Suncorp's loss or is it your loss?
Yeah, it would be Suncorp's loss. So whoever is insuring the building that's affected by the asbestos, they may try to recover the costs off the other insurer. I haven't seen any examples of that, and I'm not sure how successful that would be.
So it wouldn't go into some kind of liability, inbuilt public liability part of the policy or something?
I mean, Probably not, because it's not really that the the person who owns the house is liable as such, because there's nothing that they could have done reasonably to mitigate that risk. I mean, a cyclone comes through, it blows a house down. That's nobody's fault. And so the idea is that you look after your own customers. Like I said, that I don't think that that's been tested legally, or at least we haven't seen any attempts at recovery off the person who owns the house for that asbestos.
Because I think what then happens is, let's say the first house was worth $100,000, you're getting claims that are, you know, two or three times the value of the building.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's where this claims inflation can come from. And the second building might not even be damaged, but it has this asbestos in it, which makes it unlivable.
I'll walk back now.
Right. Thank you. So we're out of time. I'm going to ask you to do two things. One is online feedback forms, so if you could please fill those in. And the second is to join me in thanking Simone.
Thank you.